Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and really pleased to be back in Bayfield, Wisconsin, to kick off. Listen to that crowd. We have a wonderful crowd here today at the Bayfield Pavilion. A chance to visit with a lot of people from the area, from not only Bayfield, but Washburn and Ashland and other places as well, have come together today for this edition of Garden Talk. And to kick off Bayfield in Bloom, it's a wonderful opportunity. I know Art Odie, one of my guests today, I'm sure we'll talk a little about Bayfield in Bloom and some of the activities that will be going on over the next month or two. But I tell you what, I drove into town yesterday afternoon, and the daffodils are everywhere, as they always are in Bayfield. But it did tell me that the season's running a little bit late, because usually by this time the daffodils here are a little kind of past their prime. But now they're right in their prime, and it was great to be able to see them in bloom, and great to have you listening in today. And certainly, if you have a question today, I will bet that our three guests today, will one of them will have an answer for you, because we can talk about a whole variety of things here today on Garden Talk. Jason Fishbach back with us again. Jason's a UW Extension Ag agent for Ashland and Bayfield County. Don Kissinger is the Urban and Community Forestry Coordinator with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He's generally out of the Wausau area, but he gets all over the place, all around the state. And Art Odie, Art, horticultural consultant. I guess he's semi-retired. From Botanical Garden and Arboretum Management. He doesn't look too much like he's retired to me. He's running around and doing a whole lot of things. So those are our three guests today. And certainly, if you want to join in with questions, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. People here in the audience today, if you have a question, I hope you'll join in. Just raise your hand, and Judith Sears Poisson, our producer, will be more than happy to bring a microphone around to have you ask your questions. Well, Art Odie, welcome.
Welcome to you, Larry. I hope that you heard the captain's salute from the ferry boat.
One
long and two short. That's the salute that one captain gives to another on the lake when they pass each other in their oar boats or on the ferries. So you got the captain's salute this morning.
Well, that was pretty nice.
That was for your birthday.
Well, yeah, my birthday tomorrow. And I've got to tell you, every year, Joanne Collins and the gang at the Ashland and Bayfield Master Gardeners put together this wonderful birthday card. I wish everybody could see it. I'll tell you what, we'll have some pictures of it. We'll put it up on my Facebook page. We'll get to it over the weekend. It's quite a nice tribute, and I really appreciate it. And Art, you brought up plant up here.
Yeah, that's a selection of a native blueberry that was found in Friendship, Wisconsin. And so I can't say it's a real Northland blueberry, because as our sages up here say, you're not north until you're north of Highway 2. So that's sort of from southern Wisconsin. But anyway, it's a native blueberry selection. Courtesy of Northwoods Nurseries in Rhinelander. Slip my mind. Anyway, should do nicely wherever you wish to plant it, and remember us when those blueberries start to get blue.
Thank you so much. Wow, don't know what to say. I'm going home with all kinds of loot today here. Thanks, Art. And I know you've been really busy here, and maybe you could talk a little bit about Bayfield in Bloom. It's a great opportunity for people to see
well,
things
we have,
through a lot of several months.
We have a whole month of activities, and we will have garden tours on the weekend of the 14th and 15th. Have I got that right, Aaron?
Fourth and fifth.
And we invite people to come up and see all of the gardens of Bayfield. This is a wonderful horticultural community, and we have marvelous gardens and a lot of plants that you wouldn't think would grow here because we are the banana belt of Lake Superior up here.
Well, let me turn to Don Kissinger for just a minute. Don, I see you were staying. We have many, I should mention that there are many exhibits today in the Bayfield Pavilion here, and there's some great ones. I know the Bayfield School Community Gardens for Ashland and Washburn, and Bayfield has community gardens. There's Photoflora Nature, Photography, and Jay's Tree Care. And then I come to the Emerald Ash Borer exhibit, which is a really interesting exhibit. And I know, Don, you're kind of involved with that a little bit. What's our status on Emerald?
Well, our status right now is we have it in the southeastern part of the state and basically around the La Crosse area. And one find was in Green Bay, which actually was found in a trap, but not in a tree. So
no.
that was unique. And this year, the DNR always is in great cooperation with the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection, who's doing the surveying. And this year, they're putting out about 6,000 of the purple prism traps, which actually are by the display back there. And the good thing for the northwest part of the state is about 2,000 of those traps are going to be on a grid system in the northwest part, so in Douglas, Ashland, Bayfield. Soil, all these counties, because we're real concerned because this past year in the Keweenaw Peninsula in the UP, there was a find. So that's the most western and most northern find in North America right now. So we're real concerned with that.
Could have been firewood, maybe? Or
Potentially firewood. And firewood, you know, we're concerned about it with emerald ash borer, but we're also concerned with moving gypsy moth with firewood, moving oak wilt with firewood, too. So, yes, EAB is probably front and center right now, but there's a lot of other insects and diseases that we're concerned about with the movement of firewood. So basically, people from Illinois and Indiana, keep your firewood where it's at. And if for some reason you are bringing it, burn it all when you're there because we don't want to take any chance at all.
Yeah,
but
keep
at home if you can.
And Jason Fischbach, you're probably a busy guy about this time of the year. How are things growing up here?
Well, it's slow, like you mentioned. Tale of 2 years. Last year were very fast season. This year's very slow. The apple trees are just starting to wake up. So we're just gearing up, getting ready for who knows what.
Okay. Well, let me give that number again. If you'd like to join in, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. And let's take a call. Terry in Fredonia, I believe, up now. So let's go there. Hi, Terry. Thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question on what I can use in a garden which has lots of sedums and spireas and things like that, but I have a thistle problem, and I spend a lot of time out there pulling those by hand. What can I use on those?
Let's see. Jason, you want to take a shot at that?
Okay, so the perennial weeds, there's kind of a three-stage approach you take to them. In the spring, you want to try to rogue them out as soon as you can because they have these underground root systems. They're going to keep poking up new shoots. As you cut one out, another one's going to come up. So keep at it. What you're trying to do is starve the plant because it's growing in the spring with its below-ground reserves. So the more you can force it to shoot up new shoots, the more you're going to stress that system. If you can keep up with it, great, but eventually they always seem to win. So then you're looking at the same kind of thing in the summer. Just keep at it. Don't let it go to seed if you can. Then in the fall, if it gets really bad and you're throwing your hands up because you can't control it, then you might consider some sort of an herbicide application, something that's going to move down into the plant, down into the root system, and kill it that way. So you might look at something like glyphosate. You can use a real targeted approach so you don't, of course, glyphosate or Roundup will kill everything. But a little squirt bottle, and you hit it right on those shoots that are coming up. You can hopefully control it that way. Thistle is a headache. It's going to take you probably a couple of years to get it under control. The worst thing to do is go in there and till it up the whole field and try to start over because now you've just made.
Hey, you will have lots of them.
Five plants. Now you've got 5,000. So,
yeah,
just have to be persistent.
Thanks, Jerry, for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Amy in Madison. Hi, Amy.
Hi. I have questions about keeping
animals out of my garden. We live in a, I don't know, a very happy place for squirrels and rabbits. And we put in some peas about 4 weeks ago, and they just shot up, and they got eaten off right away. And I know my landlords, the heads of their tulips, the buds get eaten off. We were thinking of building a fence, but I'm wondering if as more green stuff comes up, if they'll start leaving my stuff alone, or if the garden is just especially tasty to them, or what you'd recommend. My landlords tried spraying some garlic-smelling stuff on them, but it didn't seem to help either.
Yeah, that's... You know, I was just driving, as I was driving up yesterday, I went through Washburn and I saw a really nice looking fence around a garden. It was a pretty high fence, but it actually looked pretty attractive, Art.
Washburn has a deer problem.
Yeah.
And that fence will keep out the deer, I'm sure. It's got to be 8 feet tall. That gentleman that has that garden is a real pro, I'll tell you. Because he's going to keep the deer out and the gophers and everything else. I might mention, as far as keeping animals, small animals, whatever, away from your vegetable garden, you might try some malorganite. That often can keep them away, and you should be able to get malorganite in Madison.
Oh, yeah, that should be pretty. It was worth a try anyway. It's something you'd have to reapply. Because once it rains, I assume there's a little bit of loss on the odor. But there you go. Give it a shot, Amy. But the best is a fence. And you can put a nice-looking fence up.
And I think with the fence, too, you need to remember that you need to go down half a foot,
yeah,
something like that, and make sure that the wire at that point, at the lowest point, is definitely smaller than up the above ground portions, but going underneath the ground because they will burrow.
And a nice way to do it too is to bend that fence in a kind of an L shape at the bottom, and then bury that, because then when they start digging, if they do start trying to dig down underneath, they'll be digging right by the fence and they'll dig into that piece of the fence and won't be able to get under. Anyway, I've never had that much ambition to do it that way, but.
Well, it does bring up a point, Larry. Yeah. I teach the Master Gardener class, and I use the phrase over and over again, do it nice or do it twice.
Yeah.
And with the fencing is definitely spend the time, spend the money, do it nice, do it well, and you won't have to worry about the pests, and plus the fence looks nicer.
Yeah, it sure does. We have some more callers. And by the way, if anybody in the audience has a question, please let me know. Actually, well, let's take a call or a question from the audience. Hi.
Hi, my name is Shirley from Iron River, and we have the fence. We've fenced in 3 acres, and what's gotten us is the raccoons now are coming up over the fence. They actually thumb their nose at you as they come up, and they've eaten everything. I thought they were corn eaters, but I guess they eat pretty much everything.
So you've got a couple options, and both involve electricity. And a lot of it, preferably. So you can do a single poly wire that's about a foot and a half off the ground. Problem with that is the weeds eventually grow up. You're going to have to control the weeds. And you can put that on the outside of the fence. So they're going to crawl up to it, hopefully come in contact with it. The other one is you can buy these electrified poultry netting. It's a poly fence that has a pretty small mesh, and you run a current through that. And you can buy anywhere from 2 feet high, specifically for raccoons, all the way up to a 4-foot fence. So... that's a good question.
Can you get it locally? That's a good question. Somebody may know.
The fencer and the poly wire you can, but the poultry netting probably have to order online.
All right. There we go. And let's go to Angie in St. Francis. Hi, Angie.
Hello. Somebody's going to give me a tulip bulb. I would have to plant it in a pot. Can you give me any instructions on what kind of soil to use and will it just bloom in the spring even though I keep it indoors?
All right, Art Odie, we'll start with you.
Well, I would plant it in a good sandy garden soil with a lot of drainage at the bottom, and I would not keep it in the house. That tulip has to be outside or it isn't going to bloom. And if you take that pot and bury it in the garden and maybe put a little wire mesh over it so that the animals don't get at it, and then remove that wire mesh in the spring, your tulip will come up and bloom. But I would not keep a tulip bulb in the house. I don't think you'll have good results.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. And again, you can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Let's take another question from the audience. Hi.
Hi, my name is Terry, and I'm from Superior. I have a question. When I go to try to decide what I want to plant new in my garden, I look at the plant hardiness map, and there's this little area which is zone 4 right around the lake. How wide is that area 4? Or do I just assume Superior's 3?
Superior is probably 3.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Art.
Now, here in Bayfield, that hardier zone around the lake probably gets up into the orchard country, maybe a mile away. If you're right near the lake, you will be in a much hardier zone. But it doesn't get very far back from the lake, so take that into consideration.
Okay. We have lots of people who are helping us out today. Did we get that question answered? Yeah, I think we pretty well got it answered. I just want to mention that we have a lot of people helping us out today on the show to put this together. John Munson, Paul Quello, Rudy Listig, Lucy Roberts, our PR intern. Paul and Rudy have been doing engineering forever. Paul's, he looks like he's been doing it forever too, doesn't he? John Munson, and then some great support from the Artesian House. I stayed there last night. It was a wonderful, wonderful evening. The Old Rittenhouse Inn and the Pinehurst Inn all have been very helpful to us. And then Dave Potratz and Rachel Owens back in Madison helping us out as well. And I need to remind everybody that you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with three guests. Jason Fishbach, who is a UW Extension Ag Agent for Ashland and Bayfield Counties. Don Kissinger with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, Urban and Community Forestry Program. He coordinates that. Art Odie. Art's been a horticulture consultant for a long, long time working out of the Bayfield area. So it's great to have all three of them here, and thank you so much for listening in today. And again, I hope you'll join us with your own questions at 1-800-642-1234. And let's take another question from the audience.
Hi, Kathy from Mason. And last year I planted a small orchard, pears, plums, and cherries, which were doing wonderfully, until we were hit with a very violent hailstorm on July 27th. And the trunks and branches of all those trees are literally shredded. And the nursery said, well, just to see how things go through this spring. And I don't know if I'm seeing or imagining maybe some buds starting, but I'm wondering if there's anything else I can do to help those trees along.
All right, Jason, let's turn to you first.
Yeah, I think the nursery was correct. I think you had a lot of damage, and hopefully you've pruned out the worst of it. That would be the first place to start. Then just see what develops, and you're going to have to just work with what the tree gives you over the next couple of years and prune it accordingly. So hopefully you've got some nice, healthy side shoots that come off the main branch to start over. Those trees are pretty resilient, especially the younger ones. If they have good growing conditions this year, get plenty of moisture, they'll heal themselves over from that damage. It's probably going to be, you know, an odd-shaped tree from now on, depending on where those branches are coming out. But you should be able to work with it and prune it into a nice form. The concern might be if you've got open wounds, you may have picked up fire blight in the trees. You may have picked up some black rot or other fungal problems. And so just watch them this spring. You might consider looking at some sort of a protectant program for fungal diseases, but for the most part, I think just let those trees do what they're going to do. And if you don't see decent response, if you don't see decent growth, you might start over with new trees.
Okay.
And I might want to add, you may see some of the bark that is going to slough a little bit, but underneath it, there is going to be wound wood or callus wood that will grow underneath. So as long as you see that new forming callus wood, that's the most important thing.
Okay. Very good. Sorry. We've had some great hailstorms here in Wisconsin. We had some baseball-sized hail in the Janesville area just last week, too, and I haven't been over to look at the trees there, but I'm sure there are some problems there. We've got Mark in Prairie du Chien online waiting to ask a question. So let's go to Mark. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. I actually thought of another question while I was on air. I hope you don't mind. I was wondering, I got some apple trees myself, and when and what is the best type of fertilizer to use on them would be the first question.
Okay, now these are, you just planted, or?
Yeah, they're probably 8 footers, 6 footers. They're bigger ones that I planted bare root here a couple of years ago.
Okay, they've been in a couple of years. Okay. Jason, we just go to
shoot. Yeah, well, the nice part about apple trees is they're relatively thrifty when it comes to nutrients. So the three that you're going to worry about the most, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. The phosphorus and potassium you can't really do anything about unless you've got a soil test. So you'd want to pull a soil sample this spring from the area underneath the drip line. So, you know, a younger tree like that, maybe 3 or 4 feet out from the trunk. Send that in to see what your phosphorus and potassium are. You can tell the lab what you're growing, apple trees, and they'll give you some recommendations for phosphorus and potassium. Nitrogen is something where you want to just watch the tree. If the tree is putting on 12 to 16 or 18 inches of new growth each year, it's got plenty of nitrogen. If it looks a little stunted, then you might consider a nitrogen application in the spring. And how much, it's going to depend on what you're applying. The concern, though, with nitrogen applications in an orchard is that the grass just chews it up, right? It never gets to the apple tree. So if you're going to apply nitrogen fertilizer, you either have to inject it somehow into the below the rooting depth of the grasses or keep the grasses controlled with mulch or herbicides.
Okay. And Art, you were going
to
add something.
I might add that you don't want to over-fertilize or you won't get any fruit as those
right.
trees grow older.
Yep, absolutely. Good point. Thanks, Mark. Bridget in Canton, your turn. Hi, Bridget.
Hi. I actually just had a question. I have a cat that is in love with catnip, and we've bought plants for him before, but recently I've noticed around the borders of our yard into the woods there's large patches of catnip, what looks to be catnip anyway, and I was wondering if that does in fact grow wild, and if it does, is it safe for cats as well?
Does your cat roll around in it with a dreamy look in its eyes?
Yeah, and we've actually given him some of the wild stuff, and he's pounced on it right away and ate it. So.
Yeah, I think you got some wild catnip there, hasn't she, Art?
I would think that catnip is an escape from your garden, actually. Probably your cat has gone out and planted it, so he has a constant supply.
Yeah, there's no problem. I at least with the cats that I've had with wild catnip, they seem to really enjoy it and they never get sick from it. So I don't think you have anything to worry about there. Thanks, Bridget. That's one I didn't think we'd get today. Judith has someone in the audience here with a question. Hi.
Thank you. Welcome to Bayfield again. Thanks for coming back. My name is Tessa, and I'm from Bayfield, and I have an asparagus patch question.
Okay.
I have a little older patch, but I think it's young enough to still be producing. However, over the last couple of years, it's faded badly, and I dug up one of the crowns, and the root system of it is just really deflated. They aren't nice little plump roots anymore. Out of the corner of my eye, at the end of the last season, I think I might have seen a culprit, but I'm not a bug expert. It was an orange and black looking little beetle-ish. There weren't many of them, but they were about 3/8 of an inch long, and I'm wondering if I have a bug problem or if I have other problems with my asparagus patch.
That's a good question. What do you think, Jason?
I guess the first question would be, it was relatively vigorous and healthy beforehand?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you saw they were beetles, you said?
It looked like a smallish beetle. Six legs, two segments in the body.
So I don't know offhand the particular pest for asparagus, but if it's a beetle, likely it would be the larva of the beetle that would be doing the problems with the or causing problems with the asparagus roots. If that's the case, what we can do is try to trap it, try to find it again this year, and then we can identify it and try to figure out exactly what it is. The other concern would be is that the plant is weakening and these are just secondary invaders, and it would be, you know, making sure we had a lot of rain last year up here and making sure that it drained appropriately, because asparagus really needs well-drained soil.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. And Matt and Toma, we're on to you. Hi, Matt.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm actually calling for my mother. She lives in the city, and her yard is starting to be overtaken by moss, and I was just wondering if there's a way that we can stop it, if we have to dig it out, or how do we take care of that?
Probably got a lot of shade there, I'll bet. Is there a lot of shade there, Matt? Yeah, we maybe lost Matt. Yeah. So we've got a situation where the caller would like to get rid of the moss in his mother's lawn. Isn't that pretty much a shade and kind of moisture issue for the most part? Art?
Yeah, I would consider whether or not you might prefer the moss to the grass. A lot of people go to a lot of trouble to establish a moss garden in their yard. So I would look at that from two standpoints. Do you really need the grass? Should you encourage the moss? But I think it's a shade problem and shade and moisture.
So if you really want to get rid of it, you're going to have to get rid of some tree limbs, probably, or some trees would be my guess. But you're right, moss gardening, there are, anybody here in the audience have a moss garden or do any of that? Oh, yeah, all kinds of hands going up there. Okay. So come to Bayfield, and they will show you how to really grow good moss. but it really is, it's shade and it's moisture. And you need to eliminate, if you eliminate part of that, it's certainly going to help. Judith has something.
Actually, we have a comment on the Facebook page. Candy wrote, "Hello, I have a tiny garden plot and replant tomatoes and peppers there every year. They don't seem to produce as well as they once did. What can I add to the soil to encourage these two vegetables? Thanks, guys."
Okay. So, Jason?
Well, the first would be any sort of well-rotted, aged compost or manure, something with a lot of organic matter. You're going to have to look at some sort of fertility, so that's where the manure might come in, or a well-balanced fertilizer. The other issue could be just the disease pressures building up over time. You want to try to, and that's the problem with small plot gardening, is it's nowhere else to put stuff. So either staying out of tomatoes and peppers for a year or trying those in pots, containers for a year so you can give that soil a rest, because things like early blight and other bacterial and fungal spore populations build if you have the same plants year after year. So other than that, compost and well-rotted manure.
We had some great luck last year with some tomato plants that we had in pots, and I hadn't done it in pots very much in the past, but wow, we kept up a little bit with the fertilizer this year, which I hadn't done in the past, and tried to get something in there about every 25, 30 days, and really got bumper crops of tomatoes, and it looked nice. They looked nice, too. They were a nice addition around the house. So I like your idea there. Just get them out of the garden for a while and sort of clean it out a bit that way. We have Jeff in Chautauqua with a question. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, sir. Thanks for taking my call. I've been trying for a few years to transplant some small pine trees off some property of mine into my yard. I get them up by the roots. I do a pretty good job of not breaking any roots, but a very, very poor job of getting them to take hold in my yard. They just seem to wither up and dry. And I'm talking red pines, white pines, and most embarrassingly, I can't get a jack pine to grow in my yard. I'm just wondering what the process is. what step I'm missing here to get these things to take hold?
Don Kissinger, what do you think?
I guess the first question is the soil that you're taking them from, how different is it to the soil that you're bringing them into?
Not very. I mean, some of it's just, you know, maybe 200-300 yards away, and some of it's from another chunk of my property that's about an hour north of me, but it's still all sand-based soil. Okay. So no drastic change there.
Okay, because the jack pine and the red pine will do fine in that type of stuff. The white pine likes a little bit more loamy soil. The jack pine and the red pine should do well if you have an open area where they get a lot of sunlight. The white pine does need a little bit of shade. Now, what time of the year are you doing this also?
I have pulled them up right before freeze-up in the fall, right before the ground freezes in the fall, and also really early in the spring, you know, as soon as the frost goes out of the ground in the spring. Okay. So
I guess my thought process is I would, in the spring, I've been pretty successful. In the fall, not so much successful, so that may be part of it too. So you replanted and then it's withering shortly thereafter or the next season?
No, that same year. Yeah, of course, the ones in the fall, yeah, it's usually spring before they, you know, start to wither. But the ones in the spring, no, they seem to turn orange slowly from the ground up. And
I guess I would try to do it in the spring and probably, you know, trees that are tops 2 to 3 feet tall is what you want to get. And you don't really need to go real deep because most of the roots are near the surface. Just make sure that when you get those and as you're transplanting or transporting them, they are staying out of the wind and keeping the roots moist the whole trip, and you want to get it planted, you know, basically the same day.
Okay.
I would add to that if you do transplant evergreens in the fall, do it about mid-September, just as things begin to cool off. Don't wait until just before frost. They won't have
an opportunity
to have the roots develop.
Okay, there we go. Thank you very much for that question. Judith, we have a member in the audience with a question. Hi, Peggy.
And we have a raspberry patch, and it just seems to have an excessive amount of weeds around right now. And I'm wondering, what is the right procedure to use in removing them? Am I going to disturb the plant? And then also, when the production time is done, does a person prune them down in the fall or just leave them?
Okay. Jason, you want to?
Okay, first the weeds. That's the biggest problem with raspberries is the weeds because it's so hard to control them. Now is a great time to get in there and pull them by hand. And then in 2 weeks, pull them by hand. 4 weeks, pull them by hand. Just keep at it. Till eventually those new suckers shade it out and you should have it under control. If it's really bad grass weeds, quack grass, you're always going to be fighting that. So you might consider an herbicide, a grass herbicide. You're going to have to make sure it just kills grass. In terms of the pruning, you would prune them two times. Right after fruiting. Okay, after all, you've picked everything, made your jams and jellies, then cut those old canes out. Those are called the floor canes. Get rid of those. And then the primocanes can sit there the rest of the year and grow. And then in the dormant season, before they break bud the next spring, typically April or so, you'll get out there and prune them again. And you're going to thin them into rows instead of a patch if you can. And you want about 6 to 8 canes per foot. Depending on how tall they are, you might go a little less if they're vigorous. And that should do it. The raspberry patch won't be as productive as raspberry rows because they want edge. The more sunlight that gets in there, the more fruit you're going to have. Same thing with strawberries. And so you want to make rows if they aren't already there. They're going to try to grow as a patch, so you might have to go in there and actually mow primocanes, those new shoots, a couple times in the summer to make those rows. Yeah.
All right, good. On to Kathleen in New Holstein. Hi, Kathleen.
Morning. I have a question I hope you can help me with. We bought a very expensive Japanese maple tree, one that I've always wanted, and this was 2 years ago we planted it. Last fall, my husband put hardware cloth fence around it so the molds wouldn't chew on it, and he filled that up with mulch. And now I heard on one of your programs not to put mulch up to the tree trunk because the feeder roots come up looking for oxygen. And I went out and I took all that mulch off about 2 weeks ago, I think it was, and all these little hairy roots are on top of the soil now, and I'm afraid that it's going to die. I don't know if I should put dirt on top of there, or it looks healthy. It's beautiful. It has burgundy leaves just leaved out, and but I'm just afraid we're going to lose it. I don't know what to do with all these little roots that are on top of the ground.
Okay, well, let's turn to Don Kissinger. Don?
I guess I wouldn't be real concerned about those roots there, but the reason why they are growing is because you do have the mulch there. It's a nice microclimate for it. It's moist. It's humid, so they're doing wonderfully. So I do, when I put mulch around trees, I like to keep it away from basically where the trunk and the root collar come together. I like to have that a little bit drier so we don't have any rot situations. The other reason why I like to keep mulch away from there is in the wintertime when you have the meadow mice, the voles, that's a great insulating area, and they'll get in there and they'll get up to the succulent new bark and they'll girdle their way around, and the next year you may have buds that push out leaves, but then it'll be dead the following year because basically the whole translocative system of the tree has been girdled by these animals. So the hardware cloth is good. Keeping mulch probably 4 inches away from the trunk is what I recommend. And I wouldn't be real concerned about doing anything except taking the mulch away. Those roots that are now exposed fully may die, but they are not that
critical
really.
Mm-hmm. Okay, there we go. And another question from the audience.
Hi, my name is Diana, and I'm from Bayfield. And I've heard about this gardening technique called lasagna gardening or layered gardening. How do I do it, and how successful is it? And then there's one other thing. I've heard that with animals, sometimes if you plant a separate garden for them, that they'll leave your garden alone. Put a few deterrents on your garden and then plant a separate garden for them. Some people do that.
Some people might do that. I would not be one of them.
Well, what about this lasagna gardening, Jason?
It's gotten to be really quite popular, or it's getting to be quite popular anyway.
I've not tried it, but I've heard the same thing. People like it. It works particularly well with poor soils. You're basically building the soil up instead of trying to dig something into it. So that's where it works effectively, and you're just trying to alternate with some decent soil with compost, with even grass clippings, newspaper. You know, you're basically just making layers of organic matter that breaks down. A similar concept is used with tomato production with winter rye. This is done with commercial operations where they're actually windrowing forage, winter rye, and then they plant the tomatoes right into that. And it's growing in basically pure organic matter. It's leaves as they break down. Now the roots get down into the soil system. So I think it's worth investigating, particularly up here in our heavy clays. It's worth looking at.
Yeah.
In terms of the planting the garden for the wildlife, the problem is those wildlife, they have friends, and they bring their friends, and they find the other garden because they get hungry.
Okay. There you go. How about Lee in Rockland? Your turn now. Hi, Lee.
Good morning, and my question also is about lasagna gardening. If I started in the spring now, would putting, black plastic over there to start it cooking a little faster, would that help it, or how do you get it to compost quicker?
Jason, what do you think?
Yeah, it's definitely going to speed it up. It just depends on when you want to start planting your vegetables or flowers or whatever you're going to plant. If you give it a couple of weeks, it's definitely going to heat the temperature up. It'll help cook some of the weed seeds that might be in that lasagna. So, I think it's fine. You want to make sure there's some moisture in there, which this year shouldn't be a problem, but you don't want it dry, otherwise it won't cook very well.
All right, there you go. Thanks very much for that question. Really great to be here in Bayfield, Wisconsin today to kick off the Bayfield in Bloom celebration with my three guests, Jason Fishbach, UW Extension Ag Agent for Ashland and Bayfield County, Don Kissinger with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He's a coordinator for urban and community forestry, and Art Odie, a horticulture consultant, now semi-retired from Botanical Garden and Arboretum Management. And a whole big crowd of great people here from Bayfield, the area, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
2 weeks earlier in the spring, and you get another 3 weeks in the fall.
That's fine.
Okay.
You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with a great crowd of people. We're having a lot of fun today. Answering questions from both the audience and from you. If you have a question for us, call us. The number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And we'd love to hear from you. Patty in Stone Lake has a question for you guys. So let's go to Patty. Hi, Patty.
Hi. I'm just wondering if, you know, we've had a lot of rain up here in Stone Lake, and I'm wondering if it's too early and or cool and wet to put dahlias in.
Art, what do you think?
I think I'd wait till things dried out a bit.
Yeah.
Warmed up a little bit.
Probably another week or two.
Yeah.
Okay. There you go. Hold on, Patty. We have another question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Mitzi from Wausau. Last fall, we dug up our iris bed, took all the irises out, and didn't know where to put them for the coming year for light. So we haven't transplanted them, and they're in the garage. Will they hold over? I mean, can we now plant them? And if so, how?
Okay. Jason, what do you think?
The only way to find out, I guess, at this point is to try it. I mean, if they have a bad odor, they feel squishy, or then they've rotted. Otherwise, get them out there. You want to bury them till. Are they putting up any green shoots yet?
Not that I've noticed.
Okay, well, that could be a good sign or a bad sign. But the just where the new shoot would come out, that should be just exposed. It's almost like planting garlic in the fall. You just get it in there deep enough, but you can still see it. One advantage of waiting is the frost heaving in the winter, because if you dig out the bed in the fall and then you transplant them out, which is generally what's recommended, is if they don't root, and so in the winter and spring when you get the frost action, it can actually push them up out of the ground, so you end up having to rebury them again. So if they've stored over the winter for you, get them out there as soon as you can, and you know, get them just buried, and they should be fine.
All right. Good enough. Let's go to Lori in Green Bay next. Hi, Lori.
Hi. A couple of springs ago, I was in the UP, and they had these beautiful lupines everywhere. And I found out that they were native, and I'm trying to plant natives. And I planted some, and then not long after, I found out from somewhere, maybe it was Garden Talk, that I think it's the purple are becoming invasive around Lake Superior, the waterways up there, and I live on a river, so I thought since you're in the area that maybe somebody up there would know about that.
Mm-hmm. Art Odie.
Well, there are a lot of questions about the lupins, where they came from, whether they're native, whether they're a cross between native and horticultural varieties and so forth, but I don't think I would consider them invasive, personally. For one thing, you're fortunate if they grow where you want them to grow. You can plant a lupin seed, and you don't know where it's going to actually come up and bloom for you. So I would just be happy that you've got some lupins, and I personally would not be worried about them being invasive. And I think it's at least a toss-up as to whether or not the lupins that you see around Lake Superior and so forth are actually native. I think I would call them native, personally. They've been here for a long, long time. And you'd have to do some sort of genetic analysis in order to determine whether or not these were actually natives, but I would be happy to have them bloom in my yard, invasive or not. What do you think, Jason?
Yeah, I would agree. That, I mean, they definitely can be invasive because they can spread if they find a good place. But generally, they're, you know, in the genus and species that they do exist here, but I agree. I think they're hybridizing with the ornamental that are around and the native, so you know, it's one of those calls. Plants are going to move around. That's what they do, and the beautiful plants are hard to call, you know, the bad plants, right? So I think I'd say the jury's still out to
okay.
some degree. Yeah.
All right. And Bart in Waupaca, we go to you next. Hi, Bart.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a small pine tree plantation, and basically the the pine trees are give or take knee high, and I got them like 8 feet apart as far as the rows. Would I be out of line to try to put a food plot between them rows, or would that just basically promote the deer to eat my trees and cause the trees maybe not to grow as fast?
And what do you think, Don Kissinger?
What did you say that you are looking at proposing to put between the trees?
Some type of a food plot, whether it be just clovers or soybeans.
I guess I don't know. You could give her a go. I really don't know how that would. Well, I guess what I would recommend potentially is talking to your DNR field forester in Waupaca County, you said you're from, or the wildlife biologist there, and they may tell you if that's a good process or not. As far as the trees, I don't see them hurting the trees at all. You know, if you're trying to bring in specific animals, turkeys or deer or whatever, I don't know how well that'll be. Being that you have red pine, I don't think the deer are going to bother them at all.
Yeah.
In the agriculture world, we call that alley cropping, and it's an agroforestry practice that I guess we'd prefer to see more of, because you can get a decent forage crop between the rows of trees, and the trees help with the wind as a windbreak, and you get more diversity out there in the landscape. I would agree with Don, because it's red pine, even though you're bringing deer into the area, red pine is not preferred deer browse. I would think twice if it was white pine, for sure, anything to get the deer out of there, but red pine you should be okay, and most likely you're going to have enough food around with the food plots that the deer aren't going to bother your trees.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And let's take a question from the audience again.
Hi, my name is Mike Herrick from Herbster, and I have a birdfoot trefoil problem. It's invading my wildflowers. I've got quite a large plot of wildflowers, and each year I get more and more trefoil and less flowers. What would you recommend as methods to get rid of the invasive weed and help my flowers?
Okay. Jason, what do you think?
How big is the garden or the wildflower plot?
About 3/4 of an acre. It's fairly large.
Well, at that scale, you know, handwork isn't going to work. The problem is your wildflowers tend to be dicots or broadleaves as well as the trefoil. So it's a tough situation here with that one. You could consider a burn in the spring if the conditions are right, and that's going to promote the wildflowers because they're more resistant to the burn. That's probably your simplest. You're going to make sure you have your permits and get your fire breaks put in place, but that's probably the best. Now, there are, you know, we do have wildflower native prairie planting restoration efforts, and they've developed some, or there are some nice herbicide tools, which would be another option. The problem is you've got to be very careful with what plants they will kill and which ones they won't,
yeah.
And find one that'll kill the legumes, but won't bother your composites or your other wildflowers. So I would start with the burn option if that isn't going to prove feasible, and especially in our climate, it's often hard to find a nice time or a window to burn. Then we could look at some herbicide options. But at that scale, you know, any sort of handwork is out of the question, I think.
I'd agree with the burn.
Yeah, the burn should work. Yep. All right, thank you for that question. Chris in Wales, Wisconsin, up to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. Would like to know about a clematis plant, whether if I were to put a clematis plant into a pot instead of in the ground and create a tower for it to climb on, would it'll do well, I understand that way, but will it winter well?
Jason?
Yeah, I think it will. The bigger the pot, the more soil, the better, because it's going to moderate the temperature swings, right? There's more mass to heat up. The other thing you can do is bury that pot, dig a hole in your garden and bury the pot, right? And that's just going to help insulate it or put mulch around it. The caution I always give with any sort of container gardening is don't underestimate how much water you're going to have to apply to that pot, because they dry out so fast.
Yeah.
But as long as you keep well watered and you keep it mulched or buried over the winter, you know, don't bury it in the soil, just dig it in the ground so it's maybe half the pot is in the ground, half is out, and a little mulch, that should be fine.
Okay. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Scott in Oshkosh, quick question from you.
Yes, I was just wondering what the status was on butternut trees now in Wisconsin. I have a fully grown specimen in my backyard, and I thought I'd check before I take out the chainsaw.
No. What do you think, Don Kissinger?
Well, butternut and butternut canker is a large problem, and if you have a good-sized butternut, questioning why are you looking to take it down?
Well, actually, I'm kind of tired of the mess in it. It's already 50 or 60 feet tall. It's my understanding that they don't get much bigger than that anyway. It's going to start falling apart.
I agree that it won't get much taller than that, but about it falling apart, I think as long as you have good structure and you look to see that the limbs are attached well, and as with any other piece of your home and yard, there needs to be maintenance. So if you planted a tree and haven't done anything for, 30, 40, 50 years, there's probably some pruning that needs to be done. But I guess I would not recommend taking a tree out just because it's gotten large. I mean, that's okay. What trees do.
And we'll take a quick break, and we'll be back with our guests for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio from Bayfield and Bloom. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller broadcasting today from the Bayfield Pavilion in Bayfield, Wisconsin, to kick off Bayfield in Bloom. It's, tell you what, the daffodils around Bayfield right now are really a sight to see. I really enjoy it. I drove around town and walked around a little bit, too, just to see the many hundreds and thousands. Thousands of daffodils that are planted, and it's just sort of a kickoff, and there's a whole lot more to come, and I hope you'll go to, if you're interested, you're planning, you're thinking about coming up to the Bayfield, coming to the Bayfield area, there's a website that you can go to,
Bayfield.org.
Bayfield.org has all of the information about all of the various events, the garden tours and so forth that are really something to see. So glad to have glad to have a great audience here in the pavilion. And thank you so much for listening in as we visit with our three guests, Jason Fishbach, UW Ag Agent, Extension Ag Agent for Ashland and Bayfield Counties, Don Kissinger, coordinates urban and community forestry for the DNR, and Art Ode, horticulture consultant. He's been in the business for many, many years. Questions for them, give us a call at 800-642-1234. And we're also taking questions from the audience. And we have, I believe, a question from the audience. So let's take that right now.
Hi, I'm Sarah, and I'm with the AmeriCorps Farm to School program, and I'm here today with the Ashland, Bayfield, and Washburn School Districts and the Bayfield School Community Garden. And as you're all aware, the growing season up here and the school year do not align magically. So we try to do a lot inside, and so we have a lot of grow towers in the schools, and not having a lot of success with starting lettuce indoors, and we have... I know it performs really well in cool, direct-seeded situations, but we have salad bars, and we have grow towers all year, so I'm trying to make this work, and the kids like lettuce a lot. So any suggestions for not having leggy, sad indoor lettuce, or am I just fighting a losing battle?
Might be a losing battle. I don't know. What do you think, Jason?
Yeah, I think it sounds primarily, if it's leggy, and maybe even bolting, it's a light intensity issue, which is simple enough to solve. You just have to have brighter lights and probably more of them. Germination shouldn't be an issue with lettuce. It sprouts right away as long as it's got to be very shallowly planted, and it's got to have plenty of moisture in that germinating mix.
So there you go. So probably more light, some grow lights or something to get them going. And somebody mentioned to me on the question earlier, somebody was asking about lupin growing along the shoreline, and then somebody here in the audience mentioned, I wonder if that maybe was a misidentification and that wasn't purple loosestrife. And that could be the case as well. And if it's purple loosestrife, that is indeed something we do not want. And that's for sure. So you might go online to... Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has a website that has information on invasive plants, and loosestrife is mentioned in there. And if you and also there's some nice pictures and photos and so forth of purple loosestrife. You might take a look at those and just see if it matches up. Hopefully you're still listening. If it matches up with what you're seeing along that shoreline, because loosestrife is definitely something we don't want any part of. If we can get rid of it.
The tough thing too with loosestrife is the seeds can lay dormant for years, half dozen years, 8 years, in the water, you know, in the soil, and if they're brought up, then they can start to germinate and grow also. So that's a tough thing. So once you've just seen that it's gone, it doesn't mean it's necessarily gone forever and ever.
Yeah, unfortunately.
There seems to be very good control with the beetle that's been introduced. I've noticed it myself just looking at patches that I knew were there.
Yeah, these beetles, and that's all they eat. Apparently, they'll only eat the loosestrife, and there have been really good success. I guess it's been a little mixed, but for about 80% of the time, it's been those beetles have been very effective. We have Rebecca online who's been waiting to ask a question for quite a while, so let's go to Rebecca. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. I've got some transplanting questions. One is a Virginia bluebell. When I first moved out here over 30-some years ago, I was blessed with some bluebells, and they have slowly spread. And now they've gotten a couple areas where not so good. I'd like to move them, some of them. And because they're, like, here today and then gone tomorrow, I mean, they're in blossom right now. But I know once they're finished, they're going to disappear, and I won't be able to see where they are. Should I transplant them now, mark them, and then hopefully get the right clump come fall, or wait till they're done blooming? That's question one.
Okay, well, let's take that one. Art?
What's your weather like right now?
Oh, well, right now, yesterday, 2 days we had hot and muggy, unbelievable, and then a few days before that we had cold and damp, and now we've got gray and probably 70s.
In other words, Wisconsin weather.
Well, if it's gray and 60, get out there and do it.
Yeah, why not? Might as well give it a shot right now.
Okay.
And you had one other question, Rebecca.
Oh, yes, I have actually three. I have a bleeding heart, which is doing fine, but it's buried behind other foliage. I would like to move it up more closer to the front, not in full sun, but where I can see it. And do I dare move it now, or is that something I got to move later?
They're pretty tough, and depending on whether they're truly in bloom, fully in bloom. If they're not fully in bloom, I'd give it a try right now.
Okay.
Okay. So a third question. I have a peony. I have lots of peonies. I love peonies. I plant them everywhere. However, yesterday on the slope of a rock slope, and I know what a peony looks like, there is a peony, and it's about 2 feet tall. It's coming up in kind of rock. It's going to be in a horrible place because, one, I won't see it. Two, it's going to be in shade. When can I move it?
Ditto?
I'd give it a try right now, really.
That's what I thought. Why not? You're probably...
It isn't going to be any loss to you if it doesn't make it.
Yep, there you go.
Why don't we just quick touch on transplanting perennials?
Because that's a good idea.
Pretty much all the same. Remember what the plant is doing. In the spring, it's pulling from its underground reserves to put on its new foliage until it can get its leaves out and start recharging. So it's under a lot of stress now. If you move it in the spring when it's growing, you're putting a stress on it because now it has to fix its damaged root system as well. So it can work, certainly, and if conditions are right, it works just fine. The best time to split them would be in the fall, move them. After it's put its root reserves back in the ground, then you can transplant it, give it a couple of weeks of decent growing weather to get those roots set, and then you're set for the next year. But like Art said, if it's not a very high-risk plant, right, if it dies, it's probably not the end of the world. Go ahead and try it now.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Let's take another question from the audience.
Hi, this is Sue from Cronenwetter, Wisconsin, and I have a question for Art. Art, all these beautiful daffodils are growing all over Bayfield. A lot of them are in lawns. Do people just mow those after they're done blooming? I mean, I've never seen them. I've seen them in beds before, but never just growing across lawns. And they're gorgeous. It's just breathtaking up here right now.
Well, growing daffodils or other bulbs in lawns are not, that's not the best approach from a horticultural standpoint, but from the standpoint of ease of maintenance and everything, that's certainly the way we have decided to go up here. But the main thing is that you have to let the foliage begin to dry off before you mow the lawn. That's the most important thing. When you can begin to pull the leaves out and they come up out of the ground easily, then you can mow. If you do it before that, your daffodils will begin to go downhill and be less and less vigorous, and 3 or 4 years of mowing your daffodils too early and you won't have anything. But we find that that's a very efficient way to have a good display.
We've become
kind of expert in getting these things in the ground and having a good bang for the buck.
Yeah. You certainly have. Thank you for that question. Greg in Door County, we go to you. Hi, Greg.
Hello?
Greg, yes, go ahead.
I got a better. Yes, my question goes back to the gentleman who was trying to transplant pine trees in the springtime or the fall. And I've worked 13 years at a Wisconsin tree nursery, evergreen nursery, and also I'm an owner and operator of a tree farm. And I have found out that you want to simulate what the state nurseries and the private nurseries do. And what they do is they actually root prune the tree before they plant it. And that would be the best bet there. And you'd have a lot of success that way. You root prune it in the fall before you transplant it. And then you go ahead and then you plant it.
Very good idea.
Yeah, Don, comment from you?
The thing you want to make sure about is when you do root prune it the following spring, if you're going to move it, when you do lift it up, you have to lift it several inches past where you pruned it. Otherwise, your root pruning has done you no good at all because you basically are cutting through. By root pruning, what you're doing is you're stimulating root growth. And then the following year, you cut further back, so you have a larger mass of roots. So you want to make sure that the larger mass is what you get, not the same or a smaller mass the following year after you've root pruned.
I might add that that's kind of an old-fashioned way of moving things bare root. And in order to facilitate that with larger trees and shrubs that you want to move, you might dig one half of the root prune one half of the tree one fall and then root prune the other half of the tree or shrub the next fall, and then the third fall or spring, mm-hmm. Dig it up and move it. That's an old practice. Works
yeah.
well.
And works really well. All right, well, let's take a question from the audience again. Hi.
My name is Joan from Wausau. We are in a wooded area in Wausau, and we have a significant, Wausau has a significant deer population issue. We've been supporting the commercial industry for a long time for spraying our perennials and plants. I would like to go to a homemade version of that. I've Googled all kinds of recipes. The common denominators seem to be water and eggs and pepper. Do you have recommendations on good deer repellents that can be made at home?
Eventually, deer will eat almost anything. I hate to be pessimistic, but it's a pretty tough thing to actually have a product, homemade or not, that is going to repel the deer over the long term.
What I'm constantly hear too is you need to kind of switch things up a bit and go with the one homemade or purchased product for a time and then switch to a new product or a little different product. And one of the things that Scott Craven, a wildlife ecologist, always talks about is getting
stopping them in their tracks before they really get started. So if you've got, you know, in the spring or some whatever, you want to really get them thinking about going someplace else other than your place, and maybe go over to the neighbor's place, especially if you don't like that neighbor. They once they get in a habit of coming to a particular place to dine, they just keep going back, like we sometimes do with favorite restaurants. So if you can stop them and get them turned somewhere else, that's a big help. Anybody else? Comments? Jason?
I think you said it well. You know, cayenne pepper, rotten eggs, and a mixture of water, but they eventually will get used to that too. And the main thing is, remember, the plants are growing. Seems obvious, right? But they're going to outgrow what you sprayed, so you've got to keep at it. And typically, if you alternate with two products, that's usually enough. So if you've got your homemade brew and then you've got a commercially purchased brew, and then you just alternate and you're out there, especially like Larry said, early in the spring when the deer are looking for a place to eat all summer, that's when you want to make sure they're repelled.
All right, let's take a question. Let's go back to the phones. Diane in Athens, you are next. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I have a question about iris and when do you transplant them?
Okay, transplanting iris. When's the best time? Jason?
I would definitely say in the fall, especially now when they start to put their energy into flower stalks. You don't want to stress them out right now. So wait till they're done flowering, things have gone dormant, and then lift them, and you can and transplant them then.
All right. Let's go to Dennis in Alton, Minnesota. Hi, Dennis.
Oh, yes, hi. Yeah, I've got some 2 to 3 foot tall spruce pine trees that started under my spruce trees, and the upper half of them look stressed from the winter. I'm wondering if I should bother to transplant them, and if I do, what I can do to maybe help them out.
Don, what do you think?
I think it's always worth it to try transplanting because basically you've gotten them for free, so it's not going to be a large waste. And what you may be looking at is possibly winter burn. And if that does die back, there's a lateral that will take over. I guess I'm not a huge advocate for fertilization of stuff, especially when you're just moving it. So putting it in a soil that's, you know, a good loam, sandy loam, and making sure you have some wood chip mulch around there and watering it to the proper, you know, amount. And getting roots and making sure you're getting enough of the roots, the wider roots, not necessarily going real deep. Mm-hmm. But that's what I would recommend.
Okay, thank you very much. And Mary in Lisbon, on to you. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a question regarding where our house is planted, and the main entrance is on the north side. And I know that we're going to get a lot of snow, but I was wondering about plants that I'd like to put there. I really want to get rid of what's there, which is some kind of a yew bush of sorts. And so what can I put there that I won't have to worry about the snow really killing anything off?
Jason, what do you think?
Yeah, I've got one suggestion. It's a native plant you could look at, ninebark. It's a deciduous tree. It's purple foliage. The advantage is it does very well in dense shade. You could look at basically anything deciduous is what I'd recommend because they can handle usually more snow because it filters down through the branches. The problem is if you get sloughing off the roof or something, nothing can withstand that. But try ninebark. Any of the shade-tolerant native deciduous shrubs I think would be a good option.
If you're looking for something that would give you good bloom, you might consider some of the hybrid azaleas that are available now, like the Northern Lights and Rosy Lights series from the University of Minnesota. They can do very, very well, and particularly if they're insulated by the snow, and then you've got some beautiful spring bloom.
Yeah, absolutely. They really are pretty. They really are pretty. We have a caller from Marshfield, Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
This spring, I bought a ornamental tree called the sea buckthorn, and I like to plant it up at my cabin just north of Medford. And I'd like to know: is this buckthorn an invasive? Could it become an invasive species?
I'm not familiar with that common name.
No, Don, are you?
Neither am I. I mean, just hearing that it's buckthorn, I guess it makes me real gun shy, to be quite honest. So I don't know about that cultivar. If it was me, I would not try to move it. I don't. Yeah. Jason, do you know anything about those?
I don't know a lot. There was one down at the research station in Ashland, I believe. I believe it has a use in permaculture type plantings, and it has some. I think it's medicinal properties. I'm not exactly sure, but what I've noticed is it will seedlings seem to sprout up around the tree, which means the it does. It's a prolific seeding plant. It will likely. It's kind of like silver maple. You end up with new, or not silver maple. White maple. White poplar, sorry. So you get seedlings growing out around the base of the plant, and eventually they'll spread. But in terms of its invasivity, I'm not sure. I don't think it's on any of the lists quite yet.
But it could be. I'd be real reluctant.
Especially if you're bringing it up north.
Yeah.
Leave it down south, if you don't know.
Not in our backyard. Okay. All right. Let's go to Jerry in Washburn. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. See, I've got a lawn that I'm really on the fence trying to decide what I want to do. I've got some creeping Charlie in the front yard, and, it's actually all around my yard, and I'm trying to decide if I should get out the heavy-duty chemicals and nuke them all and have a standard lawn, or, believe it or not, go out and find creeping Charlie seed and just let it be creeping Charlie through the whole lawn. Has anybody ever done anything like that?
Oh, there are a lot of people that have creeping Charlie lawns, and they haven't had to do a thing. So I don't know. What do you think, Jason?
Well, I'm all for diversity in our lawns. keep in mind, we have bluegrass and all our other main just grass in our lawns for really no good reason other than that's just what we plant, right? It's a cultural thing. Days bygone, there used to be a lot of white clover in our lawns. It fed the grasses, and it's a nice low-growing plant. And so it's really what you prefer, a mix of grasses and sweet clover and creeping Charlie makes a nice soft green surface. That's all you really want, right? Plus you get the added bonus of some purple flowers now and again. You are going to go the route of the pure grass lawn, my kind of take on the use of the broadleaf herbicides, which are very effective, is if you don't really want to use it, but maybe you want to just to make it look nice, maybe you just try it once every 3 years, because typically that's enough to knock it back. Eventually it's going to creep back in those middle years, but you don't feel quite so bad using it every year, just once every 3 years.
I have to put in a plug for the standard old lawn. I mean, mm-hmm. We have to have places that kids can play on, that you can walk on without track and mud into the house. I mean, there's nothing wrong. Pardon me, Jason, but there's nothing wrong with a good, healthy, old-fashioned lawn. And there's a lot of things that are right about it. So diversity is one thing, but you also have to remember practicality from the standpoint of what you have around your house. So. Personally, I would go for either a good lawn or go the absolute opposite direction and do something with wildflowers, whether they're woodland or prairie.
And on that note, we have to close. Boy, did the time ever fly by. I'm telling you, I want to thank so much our guests today, Jason Fishbach, Don Kissinger, and Art Odie. Jason with UW Extension, Don with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Art's been a Hort consultant for many, many years. Great to have you guys. This is our ninth year in Bayfield. Maybe we'll get invited back and we can do a tenth year up here. We'll see. And thanks to everybody. Thanks to the audience for coming today. You've been really wonderful, and I really appreciate the invitation. All of us at Wisconsin Public Radio feel privileged to be here. So thank you all, and thank you for listening here on the Ideas Network.